Welcome back, everybody, to Satisfactionist Live. I'm your host, Ben Olmos, and today we're going to be getting into an interesting topic. I was fading myself out and not the music. So welcome, everybody. I was just saying there as I was fading myself out that wanting to get into this very interesting topic today. So a couple weeks back, we did an episode on salt. And today, rejoining us again is my special guest, Chef Melissa Monsivais. Melissa, how are you?
Hey, I'm great.
Wonderful. So I reached out to Melissa because I have gotten into making pasta lately. And what is interesting and challenging about making pasta is all the different, it seems very easy. It's flour, eggs, and water, or maybe not water, but pretty much flour and eggs or flour and water. And while I got that part down, my pasta doesn't seem to be coming out very well. So it's more like, you know, it's kind of thick. It's kind of like a dumpling. And, you know, I just started thinking about, you know, why is that? So I start digging in and I come to find out there's all kinds of different flour out there, and all-purpose flour is not necessarily the best flour to use. And so I thought, who better to ask about food and ingredients and all of this stuff than Melissa. So, and Melissa, you have also a lot of knowledge around flour because you can't necessarily have that much flour.
I can't have any flour. I have celiac disease. And so the protein in flour, known as gliadin, is a protein that my body cannot tolerate. It recognizes, or rather, it doesn't really recognize it. It says, hey, this is a foreign substance. Attack, attack, attack. So celiac is an autoimmune disease, not an allergy. It's kind of funny. Sometimes people, you know, go to a restaurant and I'll say, well, I do have celiac disease. Oh, you're allergic to wheat? No, it's not an allergy. It's an autoimmune response to where my body just doesn't, it views the wheat protein as a foreign invader, and it starts doing, it basically starts attacking my own body to eradicate it. So ingesting it is very bad because it goes after all of your organs, and undiagnosed can be very, very dangerous. So zero flour for me, not even a bite, not even a taste. If I do, I feel like I want to die. So not even I can cheat with.
But you do a lot of cooking, and you still work with a lot of flour, though you can't really enjoy it.
No, but it has kind of been a blessing in disguise, because as a professional cook, it has forced me to learn the alternatives and how to use them. And so a byproduct of all that is I know a lot about flour.
Well, so one of the things that I was finding when I was doing some research around why my pasta is not coming out, it tastes more like a dumpling, is one, there's all different types of kind of like when you grind coffee, there's all sorts of types of refinement, I guess the quality at which it's ground.
Right.
I've been reading a lot about a 00 type flour, which is a measurement they use a lot over in Europe to distinguish, you know, zero from 00 to 1, which is kind of how grainy the flour can be. So I found that 00 is a better flour to use. And then also they recommended something that is high protein. I think high protein. Yeah.
The gluten protein.
Right. And so now I've got this you know, very high gluten protein flour. And it does taste better. It actually makes great bread. much better bread than all-purpose flour.
Right. And so, you know, let me talk a little bit about why that is and the different types of flours. So flour is labeled according to its gluten or protein content. So on one end of the spectrum, we have cake flour, which has about 6% gluten protein content in it. It's very fine. It's very powdery. And the reason you want a really fine flour with low gluten in it for cakes is because if you've ever had a really soft, delicate cake that just kind of melts in your mouth, that's the flour you need to get that result. If you made that same recipe with a higher content gluten flour, you'd be baking a rock. It's probably what hardtack was back in the sailing ship days, because it just would not work. A step up from cake flour is pastry flour. So cake flour is so delicate that it doesn't really work for a crust. So if you wanted to make like a flaky pie crust or a tart crust, you're going to need a little bit more structure to hold it together, or it'll just like become crumbs when you try to cut it. So that's where pastry flour comes in. Gluten content on that goes up to about 8%. So as we go up the scale in flours, our gluten content increases by about 2% in like little 2% increments. Because after that, we get to all-purpose flour. And all-purpose flour comes in around 10% of gluten protein. And it is, as its name implies, it's all-purpose. It's great for rolls, like Parker House rolls, chocolate chip cookies, pancakes, you know, crepes. It's really the flour you, well, for some fresh pastas, and we'll get into that whole 00 Italian versus American flour bit in a minute. But so every step of flour or every type of flour has a unique and distinct purpose. Then you get into bread flour, which has an even higher gluten content, around 12%. And bread flour is what they use for a lot of artisanal breads. So like your pain levant and some French breads and stuff. And the reason for that is the higher gluten content creates a stronger structure. Think of it as you will, like a net. So when you knead that dough, it has yeast in it, right? And usually a little bit of sugar. So the yeast eats the sugar, and the byproduct of that is the carbon dioxide. When that bread rises, it's that carbon dioxide that is causing it to rise. And that's where those nice thick nets of gluten fiber are important, because it's going to maintain the structure of the bread as it rises. If you tried to make that recipe with a pastry flour or a cake flour, wouldn't work. There's no support for the gases. So as it bakes, that's how come when you cut into that type of bread, it's got all those big tunnels in it, and it's chewy. It's hard on the outside, soft and chewy on the inside. And then, you know, you can go on into your hard flour or your high gluten flour. There's a flour, it's usually called high protein gluten flour, you'll see sometimes in the nature food section of the grocery store. And really what that is used in mostly is like a binder in vegan food, because it's pretty much pure gluten. So since, like, if you were going to make, say, a chickpea burger or a black bean burger, but you're vegan and you can't use eggs, that's where you would work in that high protein gluten flour, because it would bind everything together. And it really forms a nice thick patty. It cooks up really well.
Would that be good for like crab cakes as well?
No. Because crab cakes, you know, that jumbo lump crab is really delicate. right?
Right.
And so you want, usually all-purpose flour has just enough gluten to kind of bind it together, because if you use a higher gluten content, remember, the higher the protein, the tougher the result. So low protein, soft, fluffy, delicate cakes, high protein, sturdy, artisanal breads.
Got it. Got it. Okay.
And then you've got semolina flour, which is popular in pasta, like what you've been working on. And semolina is made from durum, which is a different variety of wheat. It's a very hard wheat. And that's why when you look at semolina flour, it's really coarse. It almost looks like cornmeal.
Right.
Because the wheat is so hard, you just can't grind it to a really fine powder like you can the other varieties of wheat. And so why they use semolina in pasta is because it's firm, but because it tends to not absorb moisture as well. Okay, what makes gluten? Flour and water, a little bit of kneading action, and you got gluten. With the semolina, it doesn't absorb the water very well, so it doesn't form gluten very well. So when you make your extruded pasta, like your macaronis and your spaghettis and things, it's pretty much just semolina and water, because the water is just enough to make a paste that you can extrude through that machine, and it, you know, it cuts it into its various shapes, and then you dry it. And that whole process came about as a result of, you know, usually world wars kind of bring these things around out of necessity, because
it's a shortage of supply.
It's a shortage of supply. It's a need to preserve food without refrigeration, you know, for long periods of time. So it was really kind of in the first part of the 20th century that style of pasta became popular.
Finding that you use, so like the semolina, a mix of that with regular flour is kind of the approach that I've been taking so far. I'm trying a lot of different things to try and get the mix right, if you will. But what I'm making for an extruder is different than what you make for ravioli or even lasagna. So
it's a different animal altogether.
Yeah, because I'm finding the extruded pasta has to be very firm and very hard.
You're essentially making a paste that you're pushing through a machine.
Yes. And so the drying process then is a little bit more important than if you're making, say, linguine. I don't know. I'm guessing. I haven't quite.
No, it is. See, because linguine, like ravioli, like gnocchi, like fettuccine, you know, traditionally these are pastas that were, you knead them by hand. Either you use a rolling pin, or I'm sure you've seen the little crank machines. You know, you can kind of feed them through. KitchenAid has an awesome attachment.
Yes.
That'll feed your pasta through really nicely. But those were pretty much done by hand. And then they're only dried to where the it doesn't stick together. And you get a very different result. So your dried pastas, you know how they say cook something al dente?
Yes.
To the tooth. Okay. You really only get that with dry pasta. Your fresh pasta has a different texture. It's a little more slippery. It's a little more dough-like. I mean, have you ever had ravioli to the bite?
You're right.
Not really, right? It's a little more of a doughy type thing. It's a different type of firmness than the hard pasta. And so because your final result is different, that's what dictates how you dress the pasta. That is why fettuccine goes so great with Alfredo. right? Creamy, light, delicate, buttery. It lends itself to that slippery softness of a fresh linguine noodle. And that's why, ravioli and things, you tend to see them with something like sage and brown butter. Unless it's Olive Garden, which butchers all Italian food.
Olive Garden is the Taco Bell of Italian food.
Italian food. You're generally not going to find your fresh pastas laden with heavy meats and robust sauces, because you would drown out the beauty of the fresh pasta, and the pasta should be the star. So that's why you make the different pastas for the different dishes with the different sauces.
Yeah, I mean it's a lot of fun. I actually my extruder is a KitchenAid attachment, which by the way, I think they're still having a really good sale on those right now. But it is a different animal. I have made kind of the hand rolled linguine and that pasta, but I'm finding this is just, it's different. It's a much different challenge. And then even like Asian noodles, which use even a different type of flour. A lot of times it seems like it's more of a rice flour.
That's like a dry noodle, kind of like an extruded noodle with rice flour. It's mostly just rice flour and water. But then you've got your Japanese soba noodles, which is buckwheat. And buckwheat is actually a seed that they toast and grind into a flour. So people with celiac like me like buckwheat because we can eat it.
So, one of the things we talked about was you have found a lot of different alternatives to regular flour since you can't have gluten. So what are some of the things that you have found as good alternatives? And then maybe well, let's start there. I also want to get into like, what are some of the more tricky things to do without gluten-based flours?
Well, like with our pasta demonstration, how your different sauces lend themselves better to different types of pasta, it's all about what should the end result be. It's the same with alternative flours. And even amongst so-called all-purpose flours in the gluten-free world, they're not all the same. They're not even close. So, like, for instance, okay, here's one I use on occasion. It's Bob's Red Mill all-purpose gluten-free flour. But, and you probably can't tell on here, if you could look at this flour, it's really yellow because it's mostly corn. Corn, well, it says garbanzo, potato, tapioca, sorghum, fava. Oh, they must have changed the mixture. I take that back. It doesn't have corn in it. Tapioca, sorghum, and fava bean. Each one of those ingredients have different properties. Tapioca is very glue-like and can be very tough. If you make something purely from tapioca flour, it has no shelf life. it has to be softened. Now, there's this Brazilian bread that you can get in the grocery store. Sometimes they come in these, there's like these little round buns. This Brazilian bread, every time they make it, it's pure tapioca flour, so it's gluten-free. But every recipe that I've ever seen to make this bread has loads of fat in it. Cream cheese, egg, regular cheese. It's very fat heavy because tapioca is so tough on its own. You need all of that fat to tenderize it. It has a great chew that mimics that chew that you get in artisanal bread and really good pizza crust. But it's good for about a day. And then after that, it's just too hard. It's not edible anymore. So every single flower in this mix has its challenge, and it has its own distinct flavor profile. So there are some things that I make with Bob's Red Mill that come out really good. Carrot cake, awesome. All of the things in carrot cake blend very well with these ingredients. But very popular King Arthur gluten-free baking mix.
Yes.
Entirely different animal. So this is mostly rice flour, white and brown rice flour, with sorghum, some tapioca, some potato starch, okay? Rice flour doesn't absorb moisture well, and it has a nutty, floury aroma to it. So if I want to make a cake, like a bundt cake, I'm going to use this because it gives me a really soft, delicate crumb. So if I were going to make, you know, like a yellow cake or like cupcakes with chocolate frosting or something like that, I'm going to use this. But then like chocolate chip cookies. Awesome when you add oatmeal flour into it, because the oatmeal flour, the flavors of that oatmeal go really good with the brown sugar and the butter. And it gives it a very different flavor profile. Oatmeal or chocolate chip cookies with this flour, not so good. There's no oats in here. So what is most challenging about gluten-free baking is understanding, A, the different properties that your flours have, whether it's a nut flour, which really isn't a flour, it's just a finely ground mixture of nuts, or a seed flour or a grain flour, and how those flavors correspond with the other ingredients in your recipe. And the key really is understanding those properties and applying them in a way that yields the best result for whatever it is you're making. So needless to say, my pantry, and I didn't drag them all out here, I have every imaginable wheat flour alternative you can think of. I have teff, chestnut, peanut, pea flours, bean flours, sorghum flours, all of the nuts, you know, almond, coconut, pecan flour. I mean, and it's fun to experiment with them. Some are great for frying. Some not. You try to fry something with tapioca flour in it, you're going to get glue. You're going to get something really hard. But I can make an awesome tempura batter using rice flour and corn, and you probably wouldn't know the difference. So, but it's taken many, many years of experimentation and studying and reading the works of other chefs. This is one of my favorite. This won the James Beard Award the year that came out. It's called Flavor Flowers by Alice Medrich, who's an amazing pastry chef. And she explored all of these alternative flours. And through here, I've been able to learn how to make donuts like beignets and different tarts and all manner of cakes and cookies, and it's really cool. And a lot of the times I make this stuff, I serve it to people and they have no idea it's gluten-free.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Well, that was good. That was actually going to be my follow-up. What is, you know, how different is it? But I guess if you get the mix right, if you get the combination right, and it sounds like, well, let me ask you, I mean, let's say you're doing a beignet or maybe even a very light and fluffy cake. Do you find that you have to make your own mix of flours, or is there one kind of go-to that is better for one thing versus the other? Sounds like celiac, you have to buy a lot of different types of flour to just get the, you know.
If you're a chef with celiac, I probably most people don't care about it this much. they're content to just buy the King Arthur cake mix at the store, gluten-free cake mix, and use that, and they go on their merry way. But I do everything from scratch. I don't buy mixes and things like that. So, but it, where were we in our train of thought? You were talking about the...
No, so I was saying, you know, the variety of flours that you have to use. And do you ever like put your own blend together for a particular thing?
I do. Like I created my own blend for tempura. I tried some gluten-free tempura mixes and I didn't like them. I liked my version better. I thought my version was lighter and fluffier and more delicate. So, you know, in that case, yes. I do seek out a lot of things that other chefs have already created because, you know, why reinvent the wheel? If someone else has figured out, hey, if you make this crust with corn flour and pair it with this custard, it's spectacular. Okay, I made it. I tried it. Yeah, you're right. I'm not messing with that. That was really good.
So what about what about like a very light flaky, like a phyllo dough?
So now we get into that whole, and this is where my heart breaks. Because as much as we can try to replicate a lot of the qualities of wheat flour, there really is no substitute for wheat flour. There just isn't. That it has properties that's why it's so versatile. That's why it's so universal, because of all the things you can do with it.
So you're not going to find a gluten-free croissant.
I have purchased gluten-free croissants. They pale in comparison. They can't come close at all. There are some companies that do a gluten-free puff pastry, but it's like the gluten-free croissant. It is lacking. If you've ever seen a beautiful French croissant, it's about the size of your fist, or probably with your hands, it's probably really big, but it is layers and layers. You know, there's something they call millefeuille, which means 1,000 leaves of flavor. And you can only get that by it's butter. If you could look at it on a microscopic level, it is layers and layers of gluten strands with butter sandwiched in between. And you just can't replicate that. There's no structure in rice flour. You need gluten to provide that structure. You don't get it in any of the alternative flours at all. And although xanthan is a lot of times added to provide a little bit of structure, it really has a gummy texture. And so when I've had croissants made with xanthan and whatnot, there's a gumminess to them that it just... But no, every time I see a gluten-free croissant, I get it. I try it. There's a bakery in San Francisco called Mariposa, and they make the best gluten-free croissants that I've had so far.
Well, I'm not sure if they have them, but I will say hands down, one of the best bakeries I've been to, again in San Francisco, is a bakery called Tartine.
Oh yeah, Tartine is famous. Now you see that Tartine croissant is
that's amazing.
What a croissant should be, right? Yeah. You cannot replicate that as of yet. I mean, if I could replicate that using gluten-free ingredients, I think I could be
take over like the world.
Jeff Bezos rich. I mean, it would be such a thing for the gluten-free world. And
let me ask you this. So what about things like sourdough? Because it uses a starter, is there any kind of a gluten-free equivalent to things like that?
It all comes back down to, again, gluten and the properties of gluten, because gluten provides structure and it provides texture. And it provides structure in a way that, like we said, in bread baking, it allows gases to expand and then to be trapped within the bread as it bakes. I have done all kinds of experiments with sourdough starters and stuff and different flours. And what happens is, because there's no gluten to structure it, it'll kind of rise up, but the whole thing crumbles. It becomes like sand. And you're probably not familiar with gluten-free bread, because why would you be? Why would anyone eat it if they didn't have to? But one of the big problems with gluten-free, like sandwich bread, you always have to toast it, because the minute that bread gets moisture, it crumbles. It falls apart. It becomes sand almost. Like, it's like wet sand.
Well, I have noticed there's a colleague of mine I work with, and they also have they can't have any gluten, very sensitive to it, and they I've seen them with gluten-free sandwiches, and the bread, you're right, it's just nothing to hold it together.
Yeah, nothing at all. And so it's very, very challenging. And the way they do get those, this is very interesting, so at your grocery store, at least at our local Publix, we can buy a baguette that is gluten-free. But it's not really bread so much as it is pâte à choux. Because the way that they get that bread to stay, to hold shape and structure, is with tons of eggs. So if you're not familiar, pâte à choux is eclair paste, you know, what an eclair is made out of. And you know how it has a very distinct, like it's kind of hollow inside, it's right, shiny on the outside. That's what these baguettes are. They're like giant eclairs. They're very eggy in their flavor. They look like baguettes, but they have none of the property of a baguette. I could probably, you know, put pudding and frosting on them and they'd be much better. So they're in the world of gluten-free bread. It's really sad, because there are many, many attempts to replicate. Now, you can have much more success with something like a pancake or a crepe. Why? Because the texture of a pancake is more of a soft, delicate crumb. It's more cake-like.
Yeah.
That's why we can do gluten
batter too than
right. So gluten-free cookies, pancakes, to some degree waffles, you know, cakes and pies are fairly easy to replicate. But bread,
our true artisan bread is
oh, difficult. Gosh, what I wouldn't do. And like I said, I try them all, and as soon as I bite into it, I can tell the methods that they use to try to replicate, you know, the real deal. And it always falls short. So it makes me sad as a professional cook and a former lover of all things bread that we have yet to find a way to make really good gluten-free bread.
So let's hop over a minute and talk about European flour and and why is European flour a little bit different than American flour, and you know, why do I keep getting steered towards that flour for even, you know, pizza crust, which folks say is better.
Well, here's the thing. So there really is no universal standard. You know, kind of like here we use cups and ounces, the rest of the world uses metrics, you know, grams and whatnot. So there's no universal standard. Every country has a different way of grading their flours. So in the U.S., we do it kind of like how I told you. You've got cake, pastry, all-purpose, bread flour, and whatnot. In Italy, they use a number system. So that's why you've got 00. So 00 is almost equivalent to our pastry flour. So if you don't see Italian 00, get pastry flour. It's essentially the same thing. And then their system kind of goes up. So like you've got zero. So you go from 00, which would be like cake or pastry. The next step up, which would be 0, which is like our all-purpose flour. And then they go up to 1, which is like our bread flour. And then 2 is like our hard, you know, high gluten flours. And it just every country kind of has. In England, they've got their own system. In Poland and Russia, you know, everybody kind of has their own way. Because Americans love Italian food and we do a lot of Italian cooking and we have a lot of gourmet stores that import ingredients from Italy, you know, we're more familiar with 00 flour. But really, as long as you understand the difference in the flours, you're familiar with their protein contents, and you know, I know I'm going to make bread. And so I can go to any international standard and choose the right flour based on the protein content. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it makes sense. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, they've done all the work for us, but if I should find myself in Italy one day and I wanted to make some good artisanal bread or some focaccia, I would know not to get 00 because of the gluten content. I would know I would want a 1 or possibly a 2. Well, or a 0 or a 1, I'm sorry.
That makes so sense. It is a little weird why they keep I was reading an article about using an extruder, like a flour for an extruder, and they recommended a 00, but maybe that is not right. Well, they recommended a blend of the 00 and the I always want to say Semolina, but that's
the Semolina. Well, see, what they're doing there is they're taking a low protein content flour and adding protein content to it. So, I mean, you can do that anytime. If you want to make bread flour, but all you have is, you know, when, I mean, you can blend flours and you can adjust the protein content. That's not a problem. What's weird to me is why wouldn't they just use semolina? Why go with the cake flour at all? Because, I mean, cake flour just doesn't lend itself unless it had something to do with the moisture content.
Or maybe the person blogging had no idea what the hell they were talking about.
That could be as well. You got to be careful with some of those blogs.
No, I realized that actually.
As an expert.
It's not that hard to start a blog.
No, it really isn't. And you can pretty much say anything you want about yourself and who's going to check your credentials.
This is true. This is true. Well, and that's why I have a website. You can go to, you can check my credentials. But, you know, something I saw, this is a little off topic, but it was absolutely disgusting. So I'm sure you'll appreciate it. I was watching a TikTok video, and this young lady was explaining how she does not like a lot of fat in her ground beef.
The lady that washes her ground beef.
Yes. So she took the ground beef and put it in a strainer and washed it in the sink.
Yeah.
And then returned it to the pan. This is a person who clearly does not like food.
Right.
No appreciation.
Fat is flavor. Like, I'm sorry. If you remove all fat from food, you're going to load it up with salt and sugar because it won't have any flavor.
Right. Yeah, no, and fat is actually not terrible for you. It's the overabundance of it.
Right.
Yeah, so it was really kind of disgusting. Another thing I love is Gordon Ramsay, who responds to a lot of people cooking things for him.
I love looking at those. Look at what I made, chef. What do you think?
It's garbage. You donkey. Yeah.
I wouldn't feed it to my dog.
I love that. Yeah. So I get sucked into TikTok, watching, crazy things. Well, awesome. What, out of curiosity, so what has been your biggest accomplishment with, gluten-free flour that you, I don't know, something you surprised yourself with?
One of the things that made me really sad when I got diagnosed with celiac disease is it pretty much took Asian food off the table, because soy sauce is brewed with wheat. A lot of the things that I really like, you know, Mongolian beef and sweet and sour, anything. It's not true Chinese food, but, you know, sweet and sour chicken, the fried, it's junk food, but like you crave it now and then, you know, or the lemon chicken. And so.
Oh, just sushi for you.
When I was able to adapt Chinese food to my gluten-free lifestyle, I was ecstatic.
So what do you use instead of like soy sauce or oyster sauce?
Oyster sauce I still can't do, because it's made, the prepared oyster sauce, they're all made with wheat. But tamari is beautiful and delicious and wonderful. Tamari is brewed without wheat. There are different ways of making soy sauce. There are different types of soy sauce. Some are really thick and sweet. Some are really light and delicate. Some are really salty, you know. Traditional soy sauce, like your Kikkoman and stuff, is brewed with wheat. But in Asian cooking, not everything is made. It would be like saying, oh, Americans cook everything with ketchup. Well, no, we have ketchup, we have tomato paste, we have tomato sauce, we have diced tomatoes, we have roasted tomatoes, you know. It's all tomato, but they're different. They're different properties. So it's the same with soy sauce. It's all soy sauce, but they have different properties that lend themselves to different dishes and different outcomes. So I use tamari because it's brewed without wheat, and it works really well in making sauces, and so it's not just sushi. I can have my Mongolian beef now.
Well, that's good. Still can't hit Panda Express, but at least.
Oh, my goodness. That would probably put two of my feet in the grave if I tried to eat a meal there. But I can replicate that at home. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, we're going to probably have to do an Asian food episode, because that is too something else that I've gotten into lately, because I'm just trying to test my skills at different things, and it's fun. I mean, it opens you up to different stuff. I mean, different ingredients and, you know, learning. I mean, you talk about soy sauces. The number of sauces that go into Asian cooking, from fish oil to oyster sauce to.
Well, just go to an Asian market and go down the sauce aisle.
Yeah, that's true.
They're all brown. They all look like soy sauce, but I guarantee you they're not.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I really haven't paid much, attention to the ingredients, or, you know, which sauce brings out what flavors. But, it's something that I'm going to explore and find out and figure out. So,
yeah, I kind of liken traditional soy sauce brewed with wheat is more kind of like a stout, I guess. And tamari is more like an IPA.
Interesting. But kinda, you get the flavor.
But you're still drinking beer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So folks who are gluten free, I noticed they'll drink a lot of apple cider, like hard cider, as opposed to beer, because the lack of wheat in it.
Yeah, but there are some really good gluten-free beers out there.
Or you can just maybe have scotch. No, can you have scotch?
No. Not if you truly have celiac disease. People with gluten sensitivity can generally handle spirits because the distillation process really removes a lot of the gluten from the grain. But I had some rye whiskey not that long ago and was in excruciating pain.
Wow.
It just does not work for people with celiac.
So tequila, vodka.
No, tequila is fine because it's agave.
Right.
Vodka is okay as long as it's potato.
What about rum? Since it's sugar cane?
Rum is fine because rum is sugar.
Well, that's good.
Cachaça is fine, you know, sugar. So there's a lot of spirits you can have. You just have to stay away from, unfortunately, bourbon, whiskey, and scotch.
And rye, I would imagine.
Yeah, rye whiskey, yeah, because they're all made with those grains. So.
Well, no more Everclear and punch for you.
Maker's Mark, that's what really broke my heart. I love Maker's Mark. But it's a no-go.
Well, awesome. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up for now. I appreciate this exploration into flower because there's so much to learn about it. But I think, you know, one of the things I always wondered until you explained it was how come I can't make a really light, fluffy, delicate cake? And it's because I'm using the wrong flour. So I will. I'll have to adjust that and try that again.
I can send you some recipes.
Yeah. No.
I'm buy yourself some cake flour.
That's the missing ingredient.
Sure you've seen it at the grocery store. Swan's cake flour. It's a white box that has a little red swan on it.
Yeah.
Yep. That's what that's for.
I generally use a lot of King Arthur. So.
I love King Arthur products. They're really, really good.
Yes. I mean, you know,
better flour out there.
Took a while to break away from Gold Medal and Bisquick, but.
Well, hey, at least you're not just buying a Betty Crocker mix and adding water and then buying the canned frosting. I know that's what constitutes baking for most of America, but it's really just assembling ingredients.
You know, and truly, it's not that much harder to go the extra step. I mean, I remember when, because I used to buy Bisquick, and my goal was to make a pancake better than I could get from Bisquick. I know. My bar was low a long time ago.
But, you know, we grew up on Bisquick, and it's a flavor that we know and we love.
Yeah.
And so it's funny because sometimes you're trying to replicate a flavor or a memory, even if it's an inferior product. And if someone were to give you a from scratch, beautifully made pancake, but it didn't taste like your childhood memory of Bisquick, you probably wouldn't like it.
Yeah.
It's it's weird how that works, you know. And that's why a lot of times, you know, people grow up with Kraft macaroni and cheese, and that's the flavor they want. They don't want a real homemade mac and cheese. They want that Kraft flavor. Or, you know, you grow up with the Tostino pizza rolls or whatever it is, Hot Pockets, whatever it is. And that's the taste of home comfort to you. And that's what makes my job challenging sometimes.
I tell you, I love making macaroni and cheese. I hate the box stuff. It's just so gross and waxy and blah.
Well, I'm with you, but we were also fortunate in that we grew up with a mom that cooked from scratch.
Well, this is true.
But I do feel for
grandparents and aunts and uncles that
right. I do feel for people that grew up on processed food because those are the flavors, and hence that's why Olive Garden is so popular.
Although I still remember some fried bologna in my history, so it wasn't all bad.
There's always a place for fried bologna.
Some fried
good
summer
old
sausage.
Fashioned bologna sandwich with mayonnaise on Wonder Bread.
Hot dog and tortillas. There you go. Or as they call them these days, it's a wrap. anyway, well, thank you again. Thanks for walking us down the flower path. And we'll have to come back and find another ingredient and explore that too, because this is fun.
It is fun, and there's so much to learn about all of it. And so I hope that it inspires people to become more curious about it and look into it and want to know, okay, why do I use this instead of that?
You know? Yeah, we'll have to do like butter, because butter is another one that just, there's so many variations. When you open your eyes to the world of butter and you try different things than what you normally buy at the store,
They don't culture butter anymore. You go to the grocery store, you notice you can't find cultured butter unless it's a very, you know, gourmet type butter.
Well, and when we come back, we'll talk about what that is, why, and why fat content. And even just, you know, the way that we do butter here in America versus how they do it in Europe. There's a reason why European butter is so sought after if you're really, you know, if you're really into that here. So much to explore on that. So we'll come back and we'll do some butter news, because you can actually eat all the butter you want. So that's good.
And I do. We do. Yes, I love buying butter. I buy all kinds of butter. I panic if I have less than 8 sticks of butter. I'm getting low.
All right, folks. Well, that is going to do it for this week and this episode. Thanks much for checking us out, checking out Satisfactions. By the way, if you guys are wandering around the internet or happen to be looking at your computer right now, feel free to go over to satisfactions.com. Check out our merch store. We've got all kinds of things there that you can buy. Also, you can check out past episodes and all kinds of wonderful stuff. We're continuing to grow and innovate and do different things. And by the way, I'm going to just say hello to Spain. Why Spain? Spain is trending on my downloads. So love the fact that we're getting a lot of listens from Spain. So welcome, Spain. Glad to have you. And also in the US, by the way, most downloaded in Washington and in Oregon. So people like us in the Pacific Northwest. That's good to know. Hopefully it's not that little community that they seized and overtook there in Seattle. But if you are listening, hey, great. Feel free to order our product and bring it to your little town there. All right, folks. Thanks much. We will join you again next week. Couple new shows. Until then, have a good one.